This is a broadcast of Holland United Church of Christ. At Holland UCC, we seek to open the mind and engage the heart. We are a community of justice, peace, and affirmation in Holland, Michigan, where everyone is welcome to the table.
Welcome. My name is Stephanie Rodriguez. I'm the assistant pastor at Holland United Church of Christ. I am so happy to welcome you to today's panel discussion, The Soul of Politics. It's a really hopeful thing to see such a crowded room for this topic. So thank you so much for making the time to be here today. I want to offer a special word of thanks to some of our sponsors before we get things started. I'll start with the Justice Action Team of Holland UCC, just for all of your time and commitment to get this event up and running. Our other sponsors are all listed on the program if you grabbed one of those. Thank you to Still Processing, to Vote Common Good West Michigan, Holland UCC, Douglas Congregational UCC, Hope Church, Justice and Reconciliation Ministry, First United Methodist Church of Holland, St. John's Episcopal Church, Grand Haven. We are so grateful for your support, for your sponsorship of today's event. We certainly couldn't do this without all of you. I'm very pleased to introduce our panelists behind me here. We have, in order, Reverend Dr. Jared Kramer, rector at St. John's Episcopal Church. Sarah Leach, the executive editor of the Holland Sentinel and 25 newspapers. Berghoff, political dialogue consultant. And Dr. Fred Johnson, the endowed professor of history at Hope College. We'll get things started by passing the microphone off to Stan Green, our leadership consultant, who is moderating today's discussion.
Thank you so much. And we've got a lot of ground to cover. So let's just dive right in. Just by way of the narrative arc for the day, we're going to spend some time talking about sort of how we got where we are. What's the current situation? We'll spend some time talking about what are some challenges and concerns that we have that we're trying to confront. And then we'll conclude on the hopeful note of, so what are some solutions? What are some things that we'd like to be able to do? So I'm going to start us off. It's appropriate. We have a history professor here to start us off with where we are and how we got here. Fred, I'd like to call on you to kind of start us off with, so reflect for us and give us some context around the ways that biblical interpretation has impacted the way that Christians show up in the political realm.
I finished up an MDiv at Western Theological in 2015, and one of the things that we studied there was how missionaries around the world have plied their trade. And one of the chief people who was pretty much he's passed away now, but Lamin Sana, who I believe is from either Senegal or Sierra Leone, Lamin Sana, African scholar, missionary, was very much in favor of taking the word of God and presenting it to people in different cultures in their language, that is, in their cultural context. So same message, but in their culture, in other words, giving it to them in the way that they would understand it through the lens of their culture, not the one bringing it to them. Because the problem usually had been that I'm going to bring you the word in French or in English or in Spanish, which required you to learn it in Spanish or English or French, at the same time adopt French culture, Spanish culture, or English culture, which means that every time you adopt something outside of yourself, you're shedding something inside of yourself as well.
after a while, like my African colleagues have said sometimes, the missionaries came, they had the Bible, we had the land. By the time it was over with, they had the land, we had the Bible.
Sure.
So there was that. You also have to appreciate not only the fact of what missionaries do. Missionaries do it, they do what they do also in a certain context too. Let me specify. Just about a week or so ago, I happened to be in a large gathering of people, mostly Christians, and this is a gathering of people who are very intentional about being multicultural or diverse, whatever the current phrase is. And the person leading the discussion was talking about missionaries in China during the 19th century, late 19th, early 20th century, and saying that missionaries and Christianity was under attack, and they were just killed by these people in China called the Boxers or the Boxer Rebellion. And that's all true. However, they left out the fact that the previous 50 to 75 years, China, the nation, had been dominated or tried to be sliced up by the Russians, the Japanese, the English, the French, the Americans. In other words, China was already a somewhat weak country riddled by warfare between warlords. And then when the missionaries showed up, they came to do a good thing, but usually when people resisted them because they were tired of foreign interference, they naturally resisted, so then the missionaries called what? The army of their respective nation. Now, can I just suggest something to you? If you bring the Bible at the point of a gun, you might not be received so well. So these Chinese nationalists who were the Boxer Rebellion, they were not necessarily reacting to Christianity, but they were reacting to foreign imperialism, which during that same period was what globally what was going on. Europeans colonized Africa from 1885 to 1900. They were doing the same thing in Indochina, China, all throughout Asia. So it's not necessarily so much an attack upon Christianity. So you take that message in the 21st century, apply it to the 21st century context, it sounds like Christianity is under attack. In other words, we don't want this religion for us. So the narrative has been the last few years that Christians are being assaulted from all sides. And look, I don't want to underplay that. There have been assaults upon people who are Christian for the fact that they're Christian. But given that historical reality, explained that way, it's just faded to the narrative of nationalist grievance today, which is what's fueling so much division. So if you've heard of Christian nationalism, there's a lot more emphasis upon the nationalism, not so much upon the Christian part. Christian nationalism feeds into a narrative of grievance, which this particular presentation just compounded. So now it establishes an historical link between now and then, which makes the grievances being felt today seem more justified. So we're going to get the story right. We need to first get the story right. People who are being colonized and oppressed, and look, colonization was nothing but a form of modified slavery. I don't know of any form of slavery that can be called good, no matter how good it was for the individual, even domestic slavery. And when people push back on that, they're not pushing back against an ideology, they're pushing back against oppression, generally speaking, whatever form it showed up. So 1932 sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan, 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, or the people trying to overthrow the Weimar Republic. They all had grievances and wanted to get rid of somebody's heel on their neck. That's what human beings do when they're being oppressed. So of course they were gonna do that in China. Christianity was, if anything, a footnote to why they were doing it. And the association was by guilt. The imperial nations who were trying to impose a religion and a language and a culture and more than that, ways of life on people that simply didn't want it anymore. That is not too much to expect people to resist.
Thank you. So what we have is this way in which Christianity and Christian witness becomes conflated with sort of the geopolitical issues that are at play.
There's a quote from Mahatma Gandhi, where he says, "I have no trouble with your Christ. It's the Christians I have a problem with."
So given the fact that in all these situations where we had missionaries, for example, that went into a community, there was a community that was already there. There were practices that already existed. There were ways that those folks already lived life together.
More than that, Christian missionaries showing up in Africa, you know, right around, you know, going to North Africa, then across to West Africa, eventually they penetrate that. That's all well and good, but we also tend to forget that before Christian missionaries arrive, or at least at the same time they're arriving, many of the people who are being driven into the bottom of slave ships, they're Muslims. Now, there are three great religions of the book: Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. In order to be a good Muslim, as in to be a good Christian, to be a good Jew, you have to be able to read the language, to recite it and educate yourself. So what this meant that was that people who were allegedly illiterate and unintelligent, Muslims, were literate because they had to read the Quran, they had to write it, they had to pray five times a day. So they had a cosmological system. They were intelligent, they were literate, and reduced to slavery. So if we're going to reinterpret the narrative on this, we had to go back to the very root and reinterpret everything. Christianity will have its mark, to be sure, but it's also a competing religion on the African continent and also throughout the Middle East. And if you look at it, so many of the early church fathers were on the African continent, and this spread into Europe, beyond the Bosphorus, and past Turkey, up into Anatolia, and then further north toward Western Europe.
So let's kind of take off from there, because again, in each of these contexts, there were communities that existed, there were practices that were there, there was a sense of belonging. And Christy, I'm curious, from your perspective, you talk a bit about this idea of communal belonging, and you contrast that with toxic tribalism. Walk us through the distinction you draw between those two concepts and where that places, and how that applies to this current situation.
Yeah, so human beings throughout history have a need to belong to groups. We have a need for tribes that we're a part of. But when I talk about toxic tribalism, I'm talking about tribes that have gotten to a point of dysfunction. These are tribes that have kind of a mob mentality. Within toxic tribalism, if you are not with us, the others are against us, right? And so fear is used, dehumanization is used to talk about others. When you dehumanize others who are not part of our tribe, then you can harm them. You have justified in your mind, they're not human, I can harm them. And so dehumanization has a tactic that's been used, you know, since the beginning of tribes and tribalism as justification to harm those who are not with us. And so when I talk about communal belonging, then I think it's a very, very different mentality. You still have your people that you share, you know, a foundational belief with, perhaps. Maybe you have an interest that's aligned with the people in your group. But you don't have this need to hate people who are not in your tribe. So I can say, well, this is my tribe here that I'm a part of, or my community, and there's a tribe over there. Let's mingle. Maybe I can learn from that tribe, right? And so in our political environment today, we clearly are at a toxically tribal moment, and our system is somewhat designed in a way that makes it easy, right, to be you're with us or you're with them. So you're the enemy or you're a friend. It's you're evil or you're good. So it's again, belonging to a group, but with a very, very different mindset and interacting with people outside of our group in a very different way.
So when we talk about this way in which we interact, some of that's kind of interpersonal relationships and communications. Some of the communications that we have are informed by sort of the context within which we operate. And we've got tools and resources that are at our disposal that will either inform us or misinform us. And so I want to turn to you for just, well, go ahead, Christy.
I was just going to say, you know, when you talk about toxic tribalism as well, it's helpful to understand these human tendencies that we have. And some of this comes from sociological tendencies, where if you're in a tribe, you have this belonging. If you're loudly attacking those outside of the tribe, then you are rewarded, right? If you're the mouthpiece of the tribe, you gain power. If you ever question the tribe, you might be kicked out, you'll be questioned, you'll lose privileges, and you can see this. I mean, you can look at the media, look at some of the most rewarded figures in the media. They're the loud ones, the nasty ones, those who are mischaracterizing others. And there's also a kind of neurobiological component to toxic tribalism, because again, we have actually these chemicals in our brain that reward us when we feel right. When we're right about something, the louder we are in condemning others outside of our tribe, actually these chemicals, similar to like what drugs would do, we get this high. And so there's this rewarding in our mind, there's this rewarding in our tribe. So it's you have to really consciously work against toxic tribalism.
Well, and at that neurobiological level, you know, just the fight, flight, or freeze
yes.
impulse takes hold.
Right.
You know, we're conditioned evolutionally
yes.
to deal with and respond to this idea of threat
yes.
more than affinity.
Right.
And so if we have the opportunity to conjure up a sense of threat, that feels like and sounds like it triggers some of this toxic tribalism
yeah.
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the leaders of tribes today, you know, you can look at Republicans and Democrats, but it's to their advantage to use fear. It's a powerful motivator to get people to stick close to you, to amplify their voices, because they truly, people become afraid. People in, like, I have a lot of Republican friends, and I'm a Democrat, and I can have a level of compassion when I see how afraid they are of what Democrats are going to do, because those things aren't true, and they've been lied to by the voices in their tribe, by the leaders of their tribe, and I don't know where it all ends up and where it goes, but yeah, I mean, we've probably all experienced that.
Well, Sarah, I'm interested in your perspective on this, because we're in this realm of kind of how do we get where we are and what are the conditions that exist. And so we talk about the way that voices are amplified, and that there are systems that we have in place to help us to sort of sort through or suss out where there's truth. And I'd like you to spend a little bit of time, give us a little bit of historical context then around this idea of the fairness doctrine, as that relates to the way that messages are propagated and communicated and then amplified, particularly in the media space.
Sure. So the fairness doctrine came about in the late 1940s. It was put into law in 1949. But if you remember, at that time, radio really was the dominant media space. And so the theory was that if you were going to tackle controversial issues or topics, that you would somehow give a fair opportunity for diverse opinions or perspectives to be shared to the readership, well, in this case, the listenership. And it was not clearly defined, and in a lot of ways, I think that there was a lot of good intent behind this, but then TV became, it was in its infancy, there were only a couple of channels at the time, and so conceptually, I think it was a sound idea, but then it started to be used and abused. So, for example, you could have a media company who owned two stations in the Chicago area, one of which was trying to serve some sort of what we would define as an underserved community in present day. And they would say, well, we're trying to give information to people who are maybe socioeconomically challenged. And the owner of the station could come in and say, well, we don't think that you're properly serving that community. And we think that by allocating this license to a different station across town, that they would be able to better serve this listenership. Who's to say what is equal time, what is equal space, what is equal opinions? How far do you take it? Who gets to decide what the arbiter of that truth is? And so by the time that you get into the 1960s, there's a lot of lawsuits that had been happening amongst television stations and radio stations at that point, and the constitutionality of whether or not this was something that was fair. Ultimately, it was repealed. It wasn't actually taken off of the books until a lot later, but it was no longer in force after 1987. By then, we had the advent of cable news, and so there was a flood of information that came, and there was no need to make sure that there were all of these diverse opinions, because they organically were just coming into our homes, this time through a cable box. So I think that, when you talk about ways of regulating speech, it's a very tricky thing to do. It's very difficult to ensure that those tools are being used in a way that is actually equitable. And more often than not, it ends up being warped in a way that benefits the people who wield the most power and can control those messages, such as the media companies, that can be influenced by politics.
So when we think about these companies and sort of who has the opportunity to reach those outlets, you've kind of walked us down this path. We've talked radio to television to cable, and now as we think about the variety of media that are available, I'm curious, I want to come back to you for just a moment, Fred, because when we think about the younger generations and the ways that they're consuming media, What are the things that you're seeing from the students that you encounter in terms of their engagement in the political realm, the ways in which perhaps their faith is manifested and they share with you to the extent they can, the way that faith and politics play for them, and where they're wanting to show up and how they feel they're being served by those vehicles that communicate on their behalf and to them?
My students, of course, have opinions, and sometimes those opinions are not theirs organically. In other words, they have the opinions that their parents have. But for the most part, let me speak bluntly, given that I teach at a predominantly white institution, and I am who I am, very oftentimes when I walk into a classroom, for a lot of my students, I'm the first person they've ever had teach them as a person of color, black male teaching them in class. So that's brand new. If we can get past that doorway into the subject matter, then I have to make sure they understand that I'm there for one reason only, their education. So I say it very much up front, particularly in a class, it's gonna be a lot of heavy political content, like World War I and Civil War, the issues of slavery and North-South, all that business going on. I tell them, look, I don't care if you're left or far left or right or far right. The mandate that I have for all my classes is that you have to first love critical thinking, think critically, and love democracy. So if you think critically and love democracy, we can have a conversation. I'm not here to change your opinion. I have to have the belief that if you stick around long enough and we do critical thinking, your opinion will change naturally. And more than that, if you're thinking critically and your opinion is being critically thought out, the opinion you have is the one that you will own as opposed to one that's being given to you and shoved down your throat. So that's one premise. The other premise is this. We went through a curriculum change recently where we introduced a new class in the history department called Race and Ethnicity in U.S. History. We offered that class for the first time in the spring of last year. So many students signed up for the first section. My department chair had to open up two sections. So we threw out an entire class, opened up a second section of that class, because apparently the students want to know about race and ethnicity in U.S. history at the very time that books are being banned on the subject, where legislation is being passed around the country where people are being told not to talk about it. They want to know. They know that there's something wrong, and they know that something's rotten in Denmark. They know that somebody is keeping the truth from them, and they want to find out. Now, they don't know what they don't know, but they do want to find out. They know something's going on. And again, the way I conduct that class, I told them, because it is so critical to today's environment right now, where people are using the tribalism to intentionally divide people. I'll tell them, look, if we're gonna talk about this, to get down to the root of what we're talking about on race and ethnicity in America, to have a discussion on this, I said, you may not have a discussion at this length for 16 weeks nonstop in any other part of your work life, because it's just radioactive. People are scared of it, they don't wanna touch it, So to set the environment up, I'll tell them on the very first day of class, for my white students, if you're coming here with guilt and anxiety, I need you to park that outside the door. For my students of color, if you're coming here with resentment and anger, park that outside the door, because your guilt and anxiety, your anger and resentment get in the way of me doing my job as an historian, which is to get you the facts. And most of the facts are hard, they're difficult, they involve oppression and lynching and blood and murder and injustice and all kinds of constitutional violations. It's just tough stuff. But we're not going to get to the root of being able to have any prayer of solving this if we can't get to the facts. So while I'm all for emotions and feeling and everything, it's just another hurdle I got to jump over in a too short semester to get to what's bothering them that they don't know about yet. And then once they finally start getting into what's going on, they find out about the Trail of Tears. They find out about what happened with the lynchings in Marion, Indiana, and what happened with the Carlisle schools, the Native Americans, the boarding schools, and what happened with Sylvia Mendez, you know, and the case that preceded Brown versus Board. All these things, they tell me, they're upset. They have said to me on numerous occasions, how is it possible that I went through 12 years of school, got to college, and now I'm a college senior? No one's ever told me this. They're frustrated, they're angry, and they don't know what to do. And so I tell them that's why we're there. And sometimes, you know, there's a reaction that they say, we want to go out and do something and change things. And I say, that's wonderful, but slow your roll. if it was as simple as flipping a switch and turning a dial, we would have done that already to fix it. Clearly, it takes more than that. I mentioned to them that there are people who are a lot smarter and more courageous than I'll ever hope to be that worked on this and have literally been shot down for trying to do so. Megan Evers in his driveway. King, obviously. Okay, James Meredith beat up for trying to go to school. James Hood and Vivian Malone, you know, kept from the University of Alabama. I mean, all these different people. So then we sit down and try to find out, what can we do about it? How can we bring our minds together to sit down and figure out what can we do in addressing this issue as brothers and sisters in Christ, moving together on a common plane to make this a better, stronger, more perfect union. Not the perfect union. The Founding Fathers were brilliant in that. They never said union, because they never said perfect, because they know perfection is not possible in this realm. But more perfect day by day, moment by moment. That's when we get into that discussion. And they're upset. They're upset by the politics. They don't know what they want to have a different narrative. And they're very much talking about emphasizing democracy. It's only my students, but the students I talk to, they understand that the democracy is in peril, that something has gone radically wrong, and that something's got to be done to fix it before it's irretrievable.
So we entitled this event today, The Soul of Politics. And so I want to lash on to something that you said a moment ago in your introduction to your students. And Jared, I'm interested in your perspective on this. You said you insist that your students be committed to critical thinking and democracy. And Jared, I'm curious, when we talk about critical thinking and democracy, we call this the soul of politics. One of the challenges that it seems that we confront is there's a sense that religion is, by its nature, a space within which we set aside our critical thinking. We're not invited to think critically. We're invited to accept and believe. And so how do you confront this sense that people say we ought to keep religion out of politics, perhaps because it gets in the way of the critical thinking that we need to have? But how do you respond when people say we've got to keep religion out of politics, perhaps in response to that kind of a concern?
Sure. I think that I empathize. First off, I try to understand where that comes from. I remember when I was in college as a young evangelical doing a bachelor's in biblical studies, and I remember reading Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail and getting about halfway through it and realizing that he was talking about me. And I had not realized that my whole life. And the shame I felt at my proudly held opinions about being non-political and religious and what the cost of that is, because it's very easy for me as a person with tremendous privilege to do that. So I understand that idea. I think it's massively wrong-headed. Religion at its very core, it comes from a Latin word, which is bindings, the things that bind us together. So I think religion is inherently political. It's about the way that faith binds us together. And so there are ways we do that well, that binding. There are ways we do that poorly. Good Christianity is Christianity, I think, as well, where you think critically and love your neighbor. And I think when people have an idea that the academy or critical thinking is contrary, which I was told when I went to college, it was going to ruin me on being a good Christian. Absolutely. And then when I went to graduate school, they were sure I was gone. And then, of course, I did. I left the Churches of Christ and became an Episcopalian. And they're like, I told you. See? I told you it was going to happen. Right? And so what I discovered in the Episcopal Church was a faith tradition that embraced critical thinking, that embraced the academy, that said this is how religion should work. And I had never known that that option was on the menu for me.
So you found that option on the menu for you. So perhaps you can offer something that's useful. And this is one of the things that's, you know, true disclosure, one of the things that really kind of rubs me. On occasion, we'll be in the course of conversation with folks, and they'll say, you know, I don't care how you call me, I don't care how you address me, but just don't call me a Christian. You know, Christian has been sullied so much by the divisive nature of our communications that, you know, call me something else, but don't call me Christian. So what do you say, or what would you say to those who say, I don't want to identify as Christian because of the nature of the divisive dialogue that's going on? I can't call it dialogue, divisive discussion, the percussion of ideas rather than the exchange of ideas.
I'd say I don't want to be called a Christian sometimes too, and I'm a priest. But I think the distinction I would draw is what has infected Christianity is not divisive dialogue or divisive politics. It is power. When Christianity has power, Christianity does bad things. Christianity at its core is a religion of the powerless. It is a religion of giving up power for the other. That's at the heart of it. And when you look throughout history, every time Christianity gets power, we screw it up massively. And so the answer isn't to get Christianity out of politics, is to have Christianity in politics in a healthy way, without power, in a way that it's a part of the marketplace of ideas and the conversation about competing values that you have in a pluralistic society, where you determine how do we all engage and care for each other. Because I bring my faith into politics, absolutely. I think that because of my faith, we should feed hungry people. We should give people health care. Women should have autonomy over their body. I mean, all of these are views I have because of my faith, not in spite of my faith. But I'm also very comfortable with the fact that I shouldn't get to run the show for everyone. I only get to be a part of the conversation. And we as a society have to figure out what's going to govern us. I can't privilege my view over any other view.
So, thank you. So that seems so clear on its face. So, Christy, I'm curious, what is it that makes that so hard in application? You know, those of us who are Christ followers, who are Christian, by the nature of who we are and what we profess, ought to be able to engage better than we do. And we might know better, but we don't do better. What's behind that, Christy?
A few years ago, this cartoon was going around on social media, and it's still out there, but I thought it was really a helpful image. In this cartoon, there's a picture of a teacher and his students, and he's drawing on the chalkboard, the teacher. And on the chalkboard, there is Jesus. It's a Christian school, apparently. There's Jesus. And then, you know, this chart where it splinters, almost like a family tree. Then these denominations come, and these, and you know, and it's just, and today we have 65,000 Christian denominations, I believe. But then he circles one at the very end, and he says, and this is where we came along and finally got it all right. Right? And the student says, Jesus is so lucky to have us. And I think talking about, and you know, this toxic tribalism, and throw religion in, and now God is on our tribe, and Satan is on the other tribes. You hear that language, right? Now it's not just good and bad, it's good and evil. It's we're God's people, and those people are under the influence of the devil. And so I think it's really problematic, and we're seeing it everywhere. So I think it just intensifies. I think faith intensifies it. If you don't have a healthy faith, if you're not holding your faith in a healthy way, as Jared, you know, mentioned.
I'm probably due royalties from Anne Lamott because I quote her so often. And one of my favorite quotes is, when I discovered that God hated the same people that I hate, that's when I figured out that I had cast God in my image rather than the other way around. And that's what I'm hearing you describe.
Yeah, and even, you know, taking it to this level of we have to destroy the devil, right? Add that in. I mean, and this is where atrocities throughout history have happened, when the church has power and commits these things.
Jump on it.
I want to say one thing on top of that. And this is where I think it's really helpful to actually read what people say. So I always tell people they should spend less time talking about Dr. King and more time reading Dr. King, because then they'll discover there's a lot of problems with nuclear warfare and other things and capitalism. But anyways, one of my favorite things that Dr. King said over and over again is he is not interested in victory over the Ku Klux Klaner. He's interested in the salvation of the Ku Klux Klaner. So even people who are doing things you think are abhorrent, can you see them as held captive by the systems of darkness or evil, whatever you want to call it, and that our job is to shed light and love in a way that convicts and converts. That's what. So, because I do think there are some people who are doing evil things right now in our world, and I have to be careful not to paint them as villains. I need to destroy, and instead to see them as people who's God, who need God's love to convert them out of what's holding them captive.
So for just a moment, I'm going to ratchet up the degree of difficulty on this moderation thing, because I understand that there are slips of paper that are available. So we'll have some time before we leave to entertain questions from you. So if you'll whoever has those slips, just kind of circulate those through, and we'll curate those and sort through that. And somehow, as difficult as it might be to wrangle four, I'm going to wrangle 200 or so. I don't know. We'll see how this goes. But I want to come back, Christy, and talk about your teacher for just a moment that had the long taxonomy of religion on the board. And I'm going to direct this to you for just a moment, Sarah. And because the teacher got to the end and said, you know, we got it figured out here, right? And an authority figure, you know, sharing in a piece of information.
This was a cartoon, just to...
Oh, I understand. Yeah. Yeah. Because Fred's saying, wait a minute, be kind to teachers. So, but the teacher in the cartoon had this air of authority that's there. And when those who have an air of authority or have access to great resources say things, we kind of take it at face value. And I suspect that, Sarah, you encounter situations where all the time you have to sort through and figure out, you know, where's the wheat and where's the chaff, as we'd say in religious circles. So what can we advise or help people to do as they're encountering these things, or they want to engage in a faithful way? What can we do to help people sort of sort out where there's credible information and where perhaps they're simply being led astray?
Well, I think that just a basic answer to that question is, does it sound right? That would be a good place to start, because honestly, I think that we all have a really good sense of a gut check if we really want to listen to it. And if somebody is saying something that just seems completely exaggerated, outlandish, and there's just something in it, just on its face, where you just say, that just doesn't quite register correctly with me, that's a good way of knowing that maybe you should look a little bit further. And I will tell you that as journalists, we do not have any kind of special gift. We just have dedicated time where we're paid to search for information and to talk to people. That really is all that we do. And so when we do that, you would be astounded at how much I find just on Google. And even then, you know, Are you hearing other people saying the same things? Are you seeing it reported? Like, if for example, if there's something that is being reported on one particular news site and you're only seeing it in one place, and all of the other national platforms are not reporting it or are discounting it, that should probably set off some sort of a red flag that maybe this one outlet didn't get it right. It happens. It happens a lot. I think that, you know, just trying to go and procure information on your own. Please don't use social media. It's a terrible way of using things. Unless it's something that somebody is saying and putting their own words out into the ether, then it's a useful tool, such as when public officials use it to make statements. That's a perfectly normal way of consuming what they're putting out into the ether. But don't use it as a fact-based model. You need to be digging a little bit deeper. And if you can't find the answers that you're looking for, continue to search before you form an opinion. Sometimes I work on stories for weeks, if not months, because I'm just not sure that I have it right. And maybe there's a really big component that's missing, and maybe one of my competitors at another media company might publish before me. That doesn't drive me. I want to make sure that I fully understand what it is that I'm writing about, because I have to explain it to people so that they understand what I'm writing about. And so it's something that we all should be taking that very seriously as citizens, because ultimately back in, you know, the days of yore when we had Walter Cronkite in front of, you know, on our television, they were the gatekeepers of truth. Now we have social media and the internet. We have information flooding into our brains at every single moment. And so now we are the gatekeepers of truth, and it's watered down. I'm not discounting anybody in this room, but that is a very difficult thing for everyday people to do. They don't have the time to just sit and suss out every single thing that they're being bombarded with. And so I just encourage people to try to identify what you feel comfortable with, whether that's radio, television, newspapers. If you want to take on the responsibility of going to meetings yourself to listen to you, so that you can hear it from the horse's mouth, what your government officials are saying, good on you. A lot of people don't have that kind of time. But it just take some steps so that you know that you're making sure that you're devoting, placing a priority on the fact that you are now your own arbiter of truth, your own gatekeeper of truth. And then try to talk with other people about it. And you would be, it's really interesting to see how I can read one thing and somebody can read the same exact story and come away with completely different talking points, completely different conclusions. And we have to allow for those conversations to happen and not necessarily shut people out to say you're good or bad or, you know, you're wrong, you're right. That's true discourse at its heart.
So in the work that I do, we spend a lot of time talking about the difference between task behavior and relationship behavior. And we're here and we're talking about how can we engage in the political sphere. And that's a task. It's a set of work that we all want to be able to do. But Christy, I'm curious about your perspective on this, because as we're doing this task, at the core, the way that we've done the task has served to harm relationships. And so we spend a lot of time talking about and grieving the way that relationships are harmed. So what are some things that we can do, ways that you can help us to work through the healing that has to take place to help heal some of these relationships that have been broken by the negative discourse?
Yeah, that's tough. First, you know, like as has been mentioned, I think honest conversations, honest dialogue, and leaning into the discomfort rather than running away from dialogue when maybe discomfort, maybe uncomfortable. Also, approaching this dialogue with an authentic curiosity, really being curious to understand another perspective. Because when I do workshops, I always have people say out loud together, "I know that I am sometimes wrong." And it's hard to do that, but we're all wrong at times. No one has all the information. No one has an understanding of all the perspectives. We need all the perspectives around the table. But when it comes to broken relationships, I think really entering these spaces with humility, with a willingness to actively listen and hear and understand the fears you know, I've had conversations with people on the other side of the political aisle, and we're just very afraid. And so I want to say, like, what, help me understand what you're so afraid of. Because and sometimes it's clarifying, well, that's not real. That thing you're afraid of isn't real. I don't think that. I would never think that. You know, and I often have the same feelings about those people as well, about people on the other side of the political aisle. So clarifying, just having conversations to clarify, and doing so in person, I think is helpful, just because you're reminded of the humanity of the other. And, you know, we're all have been on these long journeys throughout our lives, and all these things have influenced us. The stuff we've read, the places we've been, the people we know, where we went to school, who our teachers were, what our classes were, all of these things inform us and have led us to this place. And the same is true of the person who I might disagree with. So trying to understand, where are these views coming from, and to be able to say, hey, you know, I love you, and, you know, just to be able to do that. And so I think that can go a long way in helping. And, you know, in terms of, oh, the straw man arguments that are out there, where, you know, we're angry with people about things that aren't real, which is really prevalent right now, I think, in our political environment. There is this philosopher, his name was Daniel Dennett, and he had these rules of engaging with someone who you disagree with. And there were four rules, and the summary essentially is, you should not criticize a person's views until you are at a point where you can summarize their views in a way that makes them say, oh, I wish I had thought to say it that way. So you have to really know, you know, rather than just throw out these angry arguments, to really know, make sure that you understand a person's views before you can even begin to dialogue and critique it. So
you mentioned just a moment ago this idea of we're cautioned to or encouraged to fear things that aren't real. Yeah. So I've got one of the questions from the audience here is, while I believe that love is a better tool than fear, aren't there things we should be genuinely afraid of today? What are your thoughts, anyone's reaction? And if so, what would you say some of those things are that you are genuinely afraid of?
I will say that I'm, and again, this comes back to reading reporters that I trust and listening to sources, listening to historians who say we're at a moment that's very critical to our democracy. We are. And I was talking with some historian friends, and they said, we have exit plans for this. We have plans to leave this country, depending on how the election goes, because we understand history and we know where this could go. And so I think there are legitimate concerns over the preservation of democracy. So I would say I do fear that. I fear civil war. I mean, I have a lot of fears that I think have some legitimacy. But I don't know. Someone else want to share?
I am not afraid. But that is because I don't have a lot threatening me. So I don't have a lot to be afraid of. I fear for my daughter, for the world she's going to grow up in. That scares me. I also think it's important when we have these conversations, and you talk about the importance of having conversations with people you disagree with, being curious, being empathetic, all of this sort of stuff, to acknowledge that I don't have the ability to tell someone who's been who's vulnerable or marginalized or been traumatized that they need to do that work. Because sometimes I was in a room with a couple pastors who weren't going to let the Grand Haven Pride Festival rent their parking lot because they don't rent the parking lot anymore. But it's funny they made that decision when we asked. And one of the things they said, well, you don't want to say anything public about this because, you know, that could really hurt that. And I turned to the pastor, I said, so you, as a white man of privilege, do not get to tell a marginalized community what's best for them and what they can and cannot talk about. that's not your place. And I'm not going to carry that message to them. Because sometimes we do tell vulnerable or marginalized people, oh, just don't be scared, come to the conversation, and not realizing the trauma that's behind them, and that sometimes it's okay to not show up for that conversation. So I think that question of fear is very tightly tied to what level of privilege you have, and that shifts what I think would be an appropriate response.
Other thoughts on things that you might be afraid of?
I am afraid that people will stop critically thinking and seeking out their own information. I think that it is safer to identify with, like Christy said, a tribe that validates you rather than putting in the work, because it is work. It's work to go and to get information and to really, really sit with it and to think about it. I worry about I have three small children, and I worry about whether or not I'm teaching them to be the very thing that I want the world to be. My son asked me after the last election, well, who did you vote for, Mom? And I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. And he says, well, why not? And I said, well, first of all, I grew up in a house where we didn't get to ask that question. because we never talked about who we voted for and how much money anybody made. But I also said, I tried to explain to him, I said, I don't want you to think that whoever it is that I want to be in political power right now, I don't want you to think that that's the right way to think. I want, when you grow up and you are old enough to understand, you know, this information for yourself, I want you to come to your own decisions. And that's a really scary thing to put in the power of a 12-year-old. But it's hard because you want to influence them because you want to protect them. But I think that some of those instincts that we have it can go a little sideways sometimes. And so we have to give people the space to be who they are, even if they're not exactly who we wish they would be.
I'm also afraid of spiders, but that's something else.
First, I want to echo what Christy said. Listen to the historians. But as far as fears go, I've had this conversation in various forms with different friends of mine, and I said to them, you know, we're finally at an inflection point where I think you're going to understand. And I said to them very frankly, see, speaking just for myself, if I can just stand up for my community, I said, see, I've always known that they're coming after us. American history has shown that they're always coming after me. But now they're coming after you too. Now what are you going to do? Because people who are trying to undo this thing, a democracy, they're in it for power. It's all about seizing power and gaining more power. So certain communities have always been the target. That's not new. So we're used to that. But now everybody's on the bubble. Now what are you going to do? Some American writers have said that, you know, America's always had a very high tolerance for black suffering. Okay. But now not everybody's in the crosshairs. My question was, again, now what? So what do you do in a situation historically where I see this as being the logical outcome of a history that has had within it three different characteristics to it, one of which has been a tradition of violence. Now, I was absolutely astonished on 1/6, the storming of the Capitol, where people kept saying, can you believe this? And I kept saying, yes, I can believe it. My problem is, why can't you believe it? If after everything you've seen, after everything we've been through, the trajectory of American history, why can't you believe this too? I just never thought they would. Why didn't you believe that? Because see, here's my frame of reference. My frame of reference is that if you can literally bomb from the air a black community called the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921, if you can do that and then arrest the citizens who are being bombed, and then charge them with bombing their own businesses and homes, and wipe out the most prosperous black community in the entire country, some of whom had black ventures that had served in World War I just a few years earlier, If that can happen and nobody can be held accountable, if you can hang Abe Smith, the Tommy Ship, on a tree outside the courthouse in Marion, Indiana in 1930, and have people gather together for like look like a family photo, looking into the eye of the camera, not a single one of them looking like they're going to be held accountable or even questioned for a double homicide, not one, but a double homicide. If you can have Isaac Woodard come home in his military uniform, the last day he's in the Army from World War II, get on a bus, and then be beat to death, and literally beat to death, he ended up going blind. He's a World War II veteran. The day he gets out of the Army in World War II, and nothing happened to anybody. If all that can happen, why can't that happen too on 1-6? Because in each of those instances, they did it violently, in a culture of impunity, with a habit of no consequences. And I can't help but think that those same three factors, tradition of violence, habit of impunity, or culture of impunity, and habit of no consequences, was in their minds. If you think about Ahmaud Arbery, the guy that was killed running in his own neighborhood, when those two men, the day they were sentenced, the look on their faces when they got their sentences was absolute shock and stunned. The dude being sent to jail for murder, which should be a no-brainer, but there they were. Like, you're sending me to jail for killing a black man? Yeah, we are. So we're due, but it's happening. So 1-6, and the feeling that people could storm, not just the Capitol, but for the entire planet, this is the seat of democracy. The Senate used to be called the world's greatest deliberative body. I don't know if it can be called that anymore. And more than that, at least since the Civil War, we had a tradition working for us called the peaceful transfer of power. Don't y'all realize we can't see that anymore? That's been robbed from us. So my question is not so much what am I afraid of, but now what are you gonna do? They're coming for everybody. And that's for the people, I'm talking about the ones who are anti-democratic, the black ones, the white ones, whoever they are, because there's a whole bunch of them over there. They can't understand the gift of American democracy that's been given to us. Republican, constitutionally established democracy is at risk. And I'm wondering, why can't you see it too? So when people say, can you believe? Yes, I can believe. From the moment that the first slave set foot in Jamestown, in the Virginia colony in 1619, I've been able to believe it. My question is, why can't you believe it? What will it take to finally make you believe that this is happening right now? In the book, The Winds of War, by Herman Wouk, he's talking about a fictional character named General Armin von Roon. And toward the end of the book, von Roon is asked by one of the characters, so explain why more Jews did not leave Europe before the Holocaust really began, before it got really bad. And General von Roon essentially answers like this. He says, he thought about it for a second, he says, it was the will to not believe. That it's a conscious decision they made that, in spite of what they were seeing with their very eyes, it was in front of them, but they simply chose to ignore what they were seeing and chose to interpret it as something else. Because, you know, we have been through this before. There have been programs in Europe all along. They'd always been there, but they figured that Hitler was just another guy who's going to come along and, you know, rough people up, then he'd get in charge, and then it'll die down, things will get better. Then they didn't get better. Why do you leave then? Baru says he simply chose or opted for the will to not believe, to keep on choosing a different alternative instead of the one that was in front of them. When the writing was on the wall, choose whatever metaphor will work for you, they simply chose to either ignore it or call it something else. I don't think we can afford to do that. What about you?
So as we deal with this idea of contention that we're confronting, you know, one of the models that I work with talks about different modes of managing conflict. And usually we talk about conflict and we think of conflict as either you're avoiding it or you're leaning into it. But this model kind of teases out and says, no, actually avoiding is a strategy. It's within the frame rather than outside the frame. And it talks about the interplay between being more or less assertive and more or less cooperative. And that would yield different strategies for conflict. And right in the middle of the model, they've got a block that's labeled compromise. So I'm wondering, as you think about the way that this shows up, does compromising work? And if so, what would compromise look, sound, or feel like for you as you're thinking about this notion of how do we show up better as people of faith in the political realm?
Say that question again.
Does compromising work? I mean, we're talking about how can we show up as people of faith in the political realm. We confront those that perhaps manifest these challenges that we've just described. We have our own set of beliefs about how we might proceed. What would it mean to compromise in that situation, and how does that actually show up for us?
I cannot remember the historian, but I remember once reading that one of the chief causes of the American Civil War was that Americans lost the ability to do the one thing that they had become known for. That was the ability to compromise. It was never a smooth process. Founding fathers never meant for it to be smooth, but we found a way always of finding a middle ground. Now, it always came, always on the brink of the possibility of violence, but it never got there until finally, like Avery O. Craven said in his book, Cause of the Civil War, men got to a point where their feelings mattered more than reason. When winning started being measured in terms of loss and winning and failure and success, and then finally violence descended. One feature you need for compromise is courage. And John F. Kennedy, when he was running, I think, as a senator, wrote the book Profiles in Courage. Today you can write a book called Profiles in Cowardice. So I think that a chief element that would, at least in the current environment, that might facilitate compromise is one to have more legislators who have a spine, fundamentally, where they have the courage to compromise, that is to take a win every now and then and a loss every now and then, maybe not put it in terms of such bifurcation, but win and loss, just getting a job done. And then not having legislators who had, quite frankly, this involves us, where they have to be worried about living fear of their electorate. Because when people are afraid, you cannot dismiss people's fear. People's fear is real. And it comes for elected officials. And when they're too afraid to make compromise, guess what they don't do? They don't compromise. So if they're going to have courage, we got to have courage. That means for the people that are threatening them, we got to be just as strong as saying, I'm not letting you do that to my legislator, which means speaking up. So again, it comes back to the electorate at some point and recognizing that democracy is not some safe, self-sustaining model. It requires direct participation.
I will say that in interviewing some of the people who are either filing or considering to file for elected office right now, I'm running into one very significant talking point over and over again, and it is, don't call me a moderate. And it strikes me, I mean, I've had at least a half a dozen people tell me that, even if they're progressive, or I guess you can call them traditional Republicans at this point. And there's this a complete aversion to embracing anything that might show that you might be willing to compromise. I think that's terrifying. Because I don't know where we go from here. That's a really significant thing. And I think that we've even had candidates who have said, well, let me just talk about what I would do if I was there. And so then I always ask the question, well, what do you think about what's happening? And, well, I was advised not to talk about that, just to keep things positive. And I just say, well, we're living in this reality right now. And I feel like you have to acknowledge that. I mean, how can you compare and contrast what you would do if people were to vote you into office if you're not acknowledging the reality of the decision makers right now? You're just, by the very nature of running for office, you're saying that things are wrong somehow and that you want to be a different decision maker in the same space. Why can't we talk about that? And so that it's really challenging when I'm trying to bring that information to voters, and I'm not really able to do it to the best of my ability because of this aversion of being wrong, being ostracized, being pushed out of the tribe. I really wish that people would consider that when they're thinking about running for public office, because it does take a significant amount of spine. And I think that that's what people really want to see.
Everyone has gifts, the body is diverse, everyone has roles. I am not in the compromise crowd by a long shot for a couple reasons. Number one, I don't think you can compromise with fascism. And I think what we have right now is fascism, not all over, but definitely fascism, and you can't compromise with fascism. To me, that sounds like the strategy of appeasement. How did that work for Hitler? It worked pretty great for him for a while, until people realized that compromise wasn't working, because it's an endless suck of evil. Okay, so you can't compromise fascism. The Democrats have a problem. Their problem is not that they're not good at compromising. The problem is they suck at showing up and they suck at whipping votes. Obamacare was a compromise. It was a Republican idea. It's a compromise approach to healthcare that got painted as socialism. I would prefer socialism. Very much so, please. And so we have constantly, as Democrats, and I will claim that, I'm happy to claim that for myself personally, we have constantly shown up in good faith to compromise, given everything away, and then get nothing back for it. That's why we have not seen advancement, real advancement on healthcare. That's why we have seen real advancement on immigration reform. It's because all we do is compromise. So I think Democrats need to learn that compromising in this climate is not working. And what we need to do is we need to show up strong, we need to show up aggressively to make the world a better place, because the more we compromise, the more harm that will happen. So I vote no on compromising.
So let's take that ire toward policymakers who we've got to sort of corral into doing things, and turn it to the conversation with people that we encounter in our churches, in our neighborhood, the library, and so there are policymakers who might say, you know, that person is just deceived. They're misguided. They're driven by bad information. And there's I feel your passion around not compromising in that situation. And at the same time, when we encounter people that we see in other contexts, and we have a sense that they're misguided, they're deceived, they're subject to misinformation, how do we deal with them? How would you counsel us to deal with people that we encounter? And I see a couple of smiles that are saying, oh, just had this conversation last Tuesday. How do you deal with people that by our judgment, we would say, boy, they're just absolutely misguided?
Yeah. So I'll share a story. About a month ago, I got a Facebook message from someone who I knew 25 years ago or so. And it was this urgent, did you know that Bigfoot is in your area right now? And like, be careful, because I know you like to hike, and really panicked. And I never really interact with her, so I was like, what in the world? Is this a joke? And then I went to her page, right? And Sandy Hook never happened. The election was obviously stolen. The Holocaust is now in question. The moon landing never happened. The Earth is actually flat. And this is an intelligent, educated woman. And I was just completely shocked at this rabbit hole of conspiracy she's gone down. And we have family members who are storing up food and like just there is a lot of there's a lot of stuff out there right now, and I don't know that that can be reasoned with. I really don't. I can share my perspective. There's like a whole alternative reality, a whole alternative set of facts out there, and I mean I would love anyone else's suggestion because I honestly don't know. There's nothing you can say, you know, it's just, well, you have fake news or you don't have access to the real information like I do, right? Is the kind of response. And they these things are fully embraced, fully believed.
Similar to Christy, I had a conversation during the pandemic. And this is, you know, after a while, the death tolls got well over 100,000. And this person was saying, well, they're just making it all up. They want you to be afraid. I went, well, I'm pretty afraid, and I don't think they're making it up. So I finally said, so let me get this straight. You think that this is a big plot by the U.S. government to coordinate with all the countries around the world, to include China and Russia on the African continent, where there are some places that have communications, to just fake all these deaths and put the entire global economy on lockdown? Yes. So people can't go to restaurants or movies at night. Yes. I said, you're giving the U.S. government way too much credit. But there came a point where, you know, the same individual was saying that they just wanted to control us. And I don't know about compromise, but there comes a point where you simply have to decide that the person that you're talking to, at least in my case, I decided this person, if they were talking about Alice in Wonderland, they talk to the rabbit and believe it's actually talking back. I had to leave them alone. Because there's a basic premise of compromise, if you're gonna do it, is that you have to have somebody who's at least willing to listen to facts. That's a basic premise. I mean, facts can't be something else. Facts and truth are indisputable, so if you're debating those two things, what do you start from? You can't agree upon those two basic requirements for a compromise. So there are just some people that I think, you know, in the tradition that at least I grew up in, when somebody's just rejecting your message, you kick the dust off your sandals and move on to the next town. Yeah. Some people just have to be left behind, and I don't want to do that, but it may be necessary.
While you were talking, it made me think about a lot of the conspiracy theories of the media and how we're part of this big conspiracy to, you know, affect people's minds. And I got to tell you, I always have a really good laugh about that, because if I could get reporters to show up to meetings on time and tie their shoes in the morning, I would be happy. But it's all part of the plan. It's just, and sometimes I think, you know, from my perspective, we get kind of swept up a little bit in the absurdity of some of this rhetoric. And what my job is to basically take it all in and go, okay. And then I'll take in some other sources, and then I kind of sit and I think about that for a little bit, and then I go, all right, I'm going to have to somehow apply what a logical, reasoned person would make of all of this. And that is really what I think is missing in a lot of spaces, is that we just kind of get swept up in the hysteria of either we're very passionate about something that we're trying to achieve with the tribe that we're aligned with, or we are outraged about something that we hear another tribe, you know, pushing against us. And there's not enough just kind of like sitting in this and going, wait a minute, that doesn't even make any sense. Like, why would that even happen? Or why would that person say that? I just think that we're not really giving ourselves enough time to just kind of process information before immediately emotionally reacting to it. And I really encourage everybody to try to, you know, you're not going to be able to influence everybody in your life. You only really have control over yourself. Okay. So try to figure out a way to leverage that in a calm and reasoned way. I hear what you're saying. I don't necessarily agree. Maybe we can talk about something else for a little while and come back to this. Those are reasonable reactions. You don't always have to have this battle with somebody that is your friend or your loved one. That's okay. All of those kinds of conversations are okay. When you treat them with dignity and humanity, I think that they might end up trusting you a little bit more to maybe further that discourse when you can.
Well, and this is where we get to the tough love part of the program. Because you said something really interesting there. This idea of hearing, maybe listening might feel a little bit hard because we might have a sense, I don't want to listen to that. I don't even want to hear it. But I guess the question that occurs to me is, how does it change your posture in those conversations if your intent is to hear rather than to persuade? How does that affect? Think about conversations perhaps that you've had where you had the chance to do that. What difference does that make for you?
I'm not always angry. My wife and I, a couple of years ago, took up boating because it seemed COVID safe. And we discovered marinas are interesting places filled with interesting people, and not many people like us. And so we've made some friendships with people that are different. And one of our friends at the marina has very different views than I do, I think they kind of fall into the sort of the QAnon crowd of stuff. When I have something going on in my boat, he's the first person to walk over to help me. He wanted to take me out to lunch because he knows he disagrees with me on everything and was just curious. And so we had a great lunch. I showed up honestly for who I am, what I believe. When he said things I didn't believe in, I said, that's not something I hold up as a value or something I think is real. What I try to do, I know I will never convince this person to agree with me. What I hope to do is to help him see that I am not the boogeyman that I have been made out to be. And that in actuality, we have some deeply held shared values that we're working them out differently in terms of what those look like. And when that happens, when I become less of a caricature, when he becomes less of a caricature to me, that's just one step, which is healthy and good. And also being willing to say when someone can't occupy that space, that I'm not going to be abused. Like if you're going to just be mean or mean-spirited or call names or not engage, then we just won't have a conversation. I have enough friends. I don't need more friends. It's fine.
That's a great example of communal belonging, right? But I was going to say, similar, Jared, to what you said, is in different social media conversations and dialogues that I've been in, it's always interesting when a person who disagrees with you comes at you with name calling and, you know, all this stuff, to respond in a loving way and with kindness and curiosity, like, well, help me understand or say more about that. And then to get attacked more, you know. But then what ends up happening is people see that. Yeah. It's public and people see it. Yeah. And then they say, I think I resonate with the kindness more than what I see on this, you know, from this person. And so I think that can sometimes even open up people to thinking differently. Like, well, he's being a real jerk and she's responding with love. Like, that's interesting, you know, and it kind of throws off the narrative, because if I'm supposed to be the evil one, but I'm not behaving in that way, then it just knocks things sideways.
One more thing about that, because what you said is really key. My wife gets really anxious when I start commenting on Facebook. And I always tell her, I know I'm not going to change this person's mind. I'm commenting because of the lurker. The person who's watching this conversation and doesn't know what they think. And it came home to me a couple years ago when a friend of mine from college wrote me a letter and said, you know me as Brian, my name is Aubrey. Now,
And you need to know that watching you fight for me helped me not kill myself. Because you were willing to speak and to speak over and over again. And so I was, so sometimes these arguments that happen, it's who's listening to the argument that might need to hear something different, whether it's to change their mind, whether it's to hear someone claim their humanity when no one else will. So the lurker is really interesting.
That's a powerful witness. In the work that I do, I often talk about change and how change occurs. And in any change, I'll note to a team that on one side, there are people who are saying, what took them so long? I've been talking about that for years. And on the other side, there are people that are saying, that will never work. And in the middle, there's this mass of people. And my question that I pose to the participants in my programs is, what are those people in the middle doing? What are they doing? They're watching to see which of these witnesses they are going to follow. And so sometimes the conversation you're having with the person that's misguided, the person that is subject to misinformation, isn't at all for them. It's for the person that's trying to see, whose witness am I going to follow? What conversation am I going to have after I finish watching this conversation? So I thank you for offering that as a perspective.
If I could give a nod to the people who are not in the middle, that is not to endorse them, but I think as far as listening goes, when you run across people who are very extreme in their views, and they say, I believe this and I plan on doing that, I believe in what Maya Angelou said. When somebody tells you who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
So they may not, when I was living in Ohio, I had a friend of mine that was telling me one time about a Ku Klux Klan march. He said, you know, it's gonna be a Ku Klux Klan march near your apartment. I said, yeah, why are you telling me this? Now I'm gonna go attend. But he said, I just wanted to see what you were thinking about. I said, what I think is, if they leave me alone, I'll leave them alone. But I can't afford, what they're saying is repugnant, I think it's extreme, but I can't afford to not know they're there. I can't afford to assume that those guys are not serious about what they're saying. It may be crazy, it is repugnant, but the point, that what I got to understand is that they believe it. They believe it and they act on it. So therefore, the fact that they believe it, they're going to act on it, means that I have to be vigilant and aware of that. So there's a listening part that involves somebody being aware of who's out there in the ecosystem and that they are taking themselves very seriously and they will occasionally act on their beliefs. No matter how crazy I call them, I think they are, they believe that. I respect what they believe about what they believe. More later.
I trust that this question will be taken in the spirit that I offer it within this audience, because the phrase has been used very glibly over the course of the last several decades. But as you think about how we need to show up with our faith in the political sphere, you think about the conflicts that we encounter. You think about the conversations we want to have and perhaps lack the courage to have, but we have the courage to have and haven't found. When you factor all of that in and you step back and ask yourself, what would Jesus do? What is your answer to that? What do you think Jesus would do? If Jesus, and Jesus is perhaps in this room right now, if Jesus were in this room right now, having this conversation, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus call us to do?
I mean, that's a scary thing to even try to answer, really. But I think, you know, Jesus did not live in a democracy. He didn't, you know, have the opportunities we have to participate. So it's hard to say what Jesus Would he be voting even? I don't know. Maybe he would refrain from all of this, you know, horrible stuff that's going on. I don't know, but I think the way I feel it is, I think I take the teachings and the life of Jesus, the spirit of that, which has been one of welcome, of meeting the needs of those who are suffering, of meeting the needs of those who are oppressed, of all these communities that have been pushed out or left aside or forgotten or stepped on, or, you know, and he brought them in. That's what I see when I look at the life of Jesus. And so how does my involvement in politics lead to more of that? I mean, that's a very broad thing to say, I know, but, you know, so am I advocating on behalf of some of the marginalized people groups? How am I voting? Am I, you know, I mean, I just think that spirit of Jesus is what I try to filter my engagement through. And not always perfectly, and my goodness, I mean, there are no politicians that do that perfectly. But, yeah, that's, again, it's very broad, but we can't know. What do you do? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. But I just take that, his spirit, and I allow that to inform me.
I have to tell people what he'd do for a living, so I'm pretty good at it. it's like the internet meme. Whenever people ask what would Jesus do, I always like to remind them that flipping over tables is an option. Right. I think what Jesus would do is Jesus would be attentive to the context he's in and what is required. What I love the most about the gospel stories is Jesus knows when to bend down and wash someone's feet and when to say, "Get behind me, Satan." And I think that when we reduce Jesus to kind of, however we each reduce him, I think we lose the capacity for that critical thinking about what this moment right now demands. One of the things I love, I talked about this in a sermon recently, is that when he did go into the temple and flip over tables and the cleansing of the temple, the phrase that they remembered is, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And I talked about in that sermon that I think that the zeal that we see there is we want to, like, Jesus is going to get a whip of cords and go, like, I'm tying my whip, I'm right behind him, I'm ready to go drive some people out, right? But that's not the zeal that it was. It was a zeal that literally consumed him to the point of his death. And that's the zeal we're called to, is for God's love to so invade our lives that we are willing to give up what we have for the other. We're willing to lose what we have, knowing that we'll find something of great price on the other side of that. And that something, in knowing in each moment, what am I called to do and where am I called to respond in a faithful way, and that will always be a pleasant way.
I don't know what Jesus would do. Like Christy said, it's a daunting thing to even think of that thought. But I can tell you what I just choose to call Christ encounters that I had in that first campaign in 2008. By the way, thank you for the three people who voted for me. I stopped at a house in Muskegon, going door to door, and there were these two ladies who were two older women. One of them had just moved back to Michigan. At the time, the Michigan economy wasn't doing all that great, and so she had a job as a manager at a Wendy's store down near Columbus, Ohio. The company was reorganized, so they closed the store down. She moved back with her sister to Muskegon. Muskegon was having a pretty hard time economically. Michigan was economic at the time. And so, you know, coming back to Michigan for economic relief was kind of counterintuitive from an economic standpoint. And I sat in the living room with these two women, and the one sister said, "You know, we've worked hard all of our lives. We don't want a handout. We want to work. We want to take care of ourselves, but no one's listening to us." So here I was, this brand new candidate, you know, knocking door to door, just going about, just the camp manager said, go do this, or I went and did that. I didn't know pretty much what I was doing. I'm getting these very heartfelt stories. They're saying to me, what can you do for us? Give us some sign that you understand what we're going through, that you can help us. I didn't know what to tell them. And then her son, the sister who moved back, said to Jimmy, she had to go get her son ready for work. He was mentally challenged. He's got a job where they hired him work at some local store and had him working just enough hours per week to keep him just below 40 so they wouldn't have to pay him full-time wages and therefore benefits. And they sat there. She sent him off to work. They started crying. I started crying with them. Clearly, I wasn't very good at politics. But I found out just how deeply personal this business of politics can be if you're going about it, and I'll use this very carefully, if you're going about it what I think is the right way, that is getting in touch with people's hearts and really getting in touch with their lives and find out what do you need for the people in power to do for you. They don't want handouts. They didn't want handouts. They didn't even want help. They just wanted to know that somebody out there was listening to them. And they said, Mr. Johnson, we will vote for you because you simply came by and sat down and listened to us, to hear us. That's what they wanted more than anything else. I think about those two women a lot. I think that if Jesus did anything, he was good at listening to people and carrying their concerns on his shoulders. And I still feel bad that I couldn't do anything for those two ladies. They taught me a lot that afternoon. And I have to say, it did change the nature of whatever campaigning I did from Matt Paint that point forward.
All right, truth time. I was not raised in a religious household. I guess you would call me agnostic. So I am not coming from the Christian perspective, but I will tell you that I think that it made me a better journalist to come from that perspective, because I don't have any kind of preconceived notion of what is good or bad or right or wrong. So all I can say is that I identify with my fellow man. I think that my role in all of this is to hold the powerful accountable and to give as much information as I can to the people who are here, because I think that we all have the right to see what's going on, to learn about what's going on, and to make decisions for ourselves as a community. And so if I ever met the man, I think that Jesus would approve.
I want to thank you for your transparency and vulnerability in responding to what was a difficult concluding question. There's a lyric in a song that didn't make it into Hamilton, an American musical. And the lyric, among other things, because if you've listened to Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know that it goes pretty quick. But the lyric says, I do not know the answer, but the question is real. Yeah. I do not know the answer, but the question is real. If we as people of faith can approach this idea of how do we bring our soul to politics with the candor and the clarity to say, I don't know what Jesus would do, but I know I'm supposed to be asking the question. Because the answer to that question will help inform how I choose to show up. I do not know the answer, but the question is real. May we all be called to continue to be people of the questions that are real. I want to thank the panel. I want to thank all of you for your engagement and your interest and the witness that you will carry into the world. And with that, I'll turn it back.
Well, also thank you to you, Stan, for your participation in the modern space today. And I'll just ask for another round of a hand for all of our sponsors for today's event as well. What a privilege to bear witness to such a challenging and engaging conversation. And we hope that this was enlightening for all of you also. Thank you.
You are invited to join us for worship on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. streaming on Facebook. You can also watch these messages on the Holland UCC YouTube channel. And for more information, how to get involved, or to support our work, like us on Facebook or visit hollanducc.org.